received under some of the most prominent rabbis of contemporary American Jewry, including Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, probably the foremost conservative rabbi in the United States and in his hometown rabbi growing up. Rabbi Arthur Green, later the head of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College, who was his religion teacher and mentor during high school and early college. And Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach, a prominent Hasidic rabbi with whom he lived in Israel for several months. His secular education includes a BSc from MIT and an MBA magna cum laude from Harvard Business School. Midway through a career of teaching and consulting as a member of the faculty of Harvard Business School, he had several supernatural experiences which resulted in a dramatic and unexpected conversion to the Catholic faith and a total refocus of his life. Since then, he has pursued theological studies at several seminaries, helped produce and host a Catholic television talk show, and edited and written a number of Catholic books and reviews. His full-length book, Salvation is from the Jews, was recently published by Ignatius Press, and he has some copies here, I hope, to be able to provide, and also autograph. And we owe one to Father Drummond. Don't let me forget that, I'm in big trouble. So please join me in welcome Mr. Roy Shobin.
Hi, I'm very grateful to be here. Let me say, if any of you haven't finished eating, don't let me stop you. And similarly, if for some reason you have to leave, don't, not for my sake, because I would prefer to feel free to speak a little longer and have people leave than feel that I should speak a little bit shorter. So anyway, I think I'll start with my conversion story, as a form of a little bit of introduction to myself, what I'm doing here. As Joe said, I grew up Jewish. My parents are German Jewish Holocaust refugees. They came over. My father left Germany just after Hitler came to power, when it was still possible. My mother wasn't so fortunate and fled to France, and then France got occupied, and she got caught while she was trying to leave occupied France, across the border to free France. She was actually arrested and put on a train to a concentration camp and escaped while still in France. They met in this country, married. I was born in New York City and grew up in a suburb of New York City. And being Jewish was very much the center of my life, both religiously and also in terms of identity. Let me see where I should go with this. As Joe said, I went to MIT, I went to Harvard Business School. Growing up, I had a very devout nature and was very religious. I even, also as Joe mentioned, spent some time exploring Hasidism, which is the ultra-Orthodox Jewry, the long ear curls and black kaftans, and spent a summer as a kind of disciple of a Hasidic rabbi, the summer between high school and college, and toyed with the idea of not starting MIT in the fall, but staying in Israel, where I was at the time, and just pursuing religious studies. But I decided to go on to MIT. And my religiosity fell away pretty quickly in my first probably three semesters at college. I like to say that it was due to the sort of secular worldview and the kind of influence of evolution and so forth. But I think it was probably more due to falling into a sin, essentially. I think very often when people lose the gift of faith, it's more related to losing the state of grace than it is to what they think is going on intellectually. And I think that was the case with me. And so by the end of MIT, I was, for all intents and purposes, agnostic. And certainly didn't have any real, well, I think I was actually atheist. I did not believe in the existence of a God in any meaningful sense. Went on to Harvard Business School, and I did very well there. Was invited to return and join the faculty, and so I joined the faculty of Harvard Business School at 29 as a professor of marketing. And in some sense, that's where my conversion story begins, because what had really been going on is all my life from when I was a child, I had thought there has to be some real meaning to life, some real meaning and purpose to life, and someday I'm going to find it. And, you know, when I was a small child, it was, well, when I'm grown up, I'm going to find the meaning of life. And then when I was an adolescent, it was maybe when I get a driver's license, that'll be the meaning of life, or when I leave home and go to college, and or when I finish college and begin my career, then life will have real meaning. And at each of these junctures, it didn't. The itch was still there, the more than itch, the kind of angst inside for there to have to be some real purpose to life. And it kept being temporarily satisfied by the next external goal. And at this point in my life, when I was put named to the faculty of Harvard Business School, there were no more external goals. I had accomplished everything that I had hoped to and more, and yet there was still no meaning and purpose to life. And so in the presence of this kind of external success, at the same time I was in a state of deeper internal despair, really, than I had ever been in. And it was in this state, I was walking in nature early one morning in the woods behind the beach at Cape Cod, which was really the only place I found solace, was being alone in a somewhat contemplative state in nature, when I received the greatest single grace of my life. I was walking alone, and from one moment to the next, I found myself very tangibly, immediately aware of being in the presence of God, looking at my life as though I were looking back on my life from after death in the presence of God. And in an instant, I saw everything that I would be happy about and everything that I would wish I had done differently, how I would feel about everything when I died. I saw that my two greatest regrets when I died would be all of the time and energy I wasted worrying about not being loved, when every moment of my existence I was held in a sea of love greater than I could imagine coming from this all-knowing, all-loving God. And my other great regret would be every hour that I wasted not doing anything of value in the eyes of heaven. I saw that everything that had ever happened to me had been the most perfect thing that could have been arranged coming from the hand of this all-knowing and all-loving God, especially those things which had seemed the greatest disasters at the time, the things which had caused the greatest suffering. I saw that everything that one did had a moral content, for good or for ill, that mattered for all eternity. And I certainly saw that my life had far greater meaning and purpose than I had ever hoped for or imagined, which was to love and serve this God who was revealing himself to me. And so I prayed on the spot to know his name so I could know what religion to follow. I couldn't associate this God with my image of God from the Old Testament. And so I prayed to know who he was so that I would know what religion to follow. And I remember I was actually still walking along praying, "Lord, let me know your name so I can worship and serve you properly. I don't mind if you're Buddha and I have to become a Buddhist. I don't mind if you're Apollo and I have to become a Roman pagan. I don't mind if you're Christian and I have to become Hindu, as long as you're not Christ and I have to become Christian." And he respected that prayer. He didn't reveal his name to me. And I think that actually the reason I pray that and the reason he didn't reveal his name to me is I think I might have actually walked away from the experience had I been presented with everything at once and known that this was Christ. So I didn't know who he was, but I did know the meaning and purpose of my life, and I went back to Cambridge, where I was living at the time, in some sense happy for the first time since childhood, because everything that I had wished for was true. We really do live forever. There really is a providential, loving God in control of everything. And there really is infinite. It's up to us. There's the potential for infinite meaning and purpose every minute of our lives. I knew, of course, from that day on, the meaning and purpose of my life. The first step to that was to find out who this God was and to know, how to worship him, how to follow him. So I'm going to give the short version. I'll leave a little time for questions, after the talk. There's a little description. I'll put a little plug. There's a description of my conversion story, my witness testimony, in the book. I also have a website, salvationsfromthejews.com, that has much more extensive description of my conversion story. But I could spend an hour going through the details of my conversion story, and I don't know that that's appropriate. But so, for a year, I explored various unsuccessful paths to follow this God. I will tell one little piece of this, which is I go back to Cambridge. And this was a mystical experience, right? I had never heard of a mystical experience, right? Because I don't want to say because I'm Jewish, but because I'm Jewish. And so I go back to Cambridge having had this mystical experience and determined to track it down and figure out what's going on. So what do I have to do? I have to find a mystic to talk to, right? Which wasn't a very safe thing to do in Cambridge in the early 1980s. So I call up this guy who had worked as a temp typist at one of the places where I consulted, who I knew was a self-styled mystic, Kabbalist, and I called him up, His name was Bob, and I said, look, Bob, is your interest just theoretical or is it practical too in mysticism? And he said, oh, no, it's very, it's very experientially based. So I made an appointment to go see him. I go over to his apartment, and he is, by the way, a fallen away Catholic, studying Kabbalah, so kind of as a would-be Jew. But anyway, he puts me on all kinds of wrong tracks having to do with Hindu meditation and everything. But while I'm at his apartment, there's a coffee table book on his coffee table, big picture book, and it's called something like The 100 Greatest Miracles of Modern Times. And when he goes into the kitchen to make some tea for us, I leaf through the book, and I see one page on the miracle of Fatima. Now, I had never heard of this, right? And I'm reading this. You know, here was a tangible miracle that 80,000, 100,000 people saw, including, you know, communists and atheists and skeptics. And I'm blown away. And Bob comes back from the kitchen, and I say, is this really true? Did this really happen? He said, yes. I say, does anyone else know about it? And he says, oh, yeah, Catholics, all Catholics know about it. And I said, well, is it written up anywhere? Is there anything else written on it? And he said, yeah, just go to the public library. You'll find, a dozen books on it. And my reaction was one of indignation. I was so angry and indignant all my life, right, because I had grown up as a devout Jew. I had read the Old Testament, read about the miracles in the Old Testament. And my one question always to the Hebrew school teacher was, why did God used to perform miracles and no longer perform miracles? And the fact that there was this miracle in modern times, well attested to, that nobody had told me about, I just felt it was a total violation. So let me make that, I noticed with great glee, the caption was energizing the evangelizers. There are lots of good ways to evangelize, but letting people know about objectively verifiable miracles having to do with the Catholic faith is a pretty good first step. there are tons of them. They're the apparitions. They're the miracles at Lourdes, which are extremely carefully investigated before they're attested to, and so forth. But anyway, so I think that was really the fruit of that visit. I spent a year exploring these wrong paths having to do with New Age, but this story of Fatima stayed in the back of my mind. And every night before I went to sleep, I would say a short prayer to my Lord and Master, who had revealed himself on the beach, to know his name. And a year to the day after the initial experience, I went to sleep. I felt as though I was woken up by a hand on my shoulder. Now, I know that this was a dream. I know that if there was a video camera in the room, it would have shown me asleep. But the memory of it is as though I were awake, had been awake. And the experience in my mind was as though I was awake. In other words, my mental state felt like being awake. So I felt as though I were awoken by a hand on my shoulder, taken to a room and left alone with the most beautiful young woman that I could imagine. And I knew without being told that it was the Blessed Virgin Mary. Just to be in her presence was to be in a state of ecstasy greater than I imagined could exist, coming from the love, the purity and the intensity of the love flowing from her. My initial reaction was I just wanted to throw myself on my knees and forgive me for confessing this, so to speak, and worship her, give her due honor. She said that she would answer any questions that I might have for her. I remember the feeling of standing there, of weighing different questions in my mind. Should I ask this? Should I ask that? I remember the questions I asked, the answers. I'll say the first question, which came from that initial impulse to throw myself on my knees and honor her properly. And I knew at the time, I said to myself, oh my goodness, I wish I at least knew the Hail Mary. But I didn't, and I wanted to say a prayer to honor her. So my first question to her was, I think what I really want to ask her was, could you teach me the Hail Mary? But I was too proud for that. So instead I asked her, what's your favorite prayer to you? And her initial response was, I love all prayers to me. But I was a little pushy. Maybe that has to do with being a New York Jew, and maybe it doesn't. But I said, oh, come on, you must love some prayers to you more than others. And she relented, and she recited a prayer to me, but it was in Portuguese, and I don't know any Portuguese. So the best I could do was make the effort to phonetically remember the first few syllables of the prayer. And the next morning when I woke up, I immediately wrote down phonetically those syllables. And later, when I met a Portuguese Catholic woman, I asked her to recite all the Marian prayers that she knew. so that I could identify it. And to my best of my ability, it was Immaculate Mary conceived without sin. Pray for us, have recourse to thee. In Portuguese. Now, I think it was in Portuguese in part because of the association with the miracle Fatima, in part because of the love and devotion. This I knew at the time. It was part of the infused knowledge. For instance, she never told me it was Portuguese. I just knew it. Having to do with the devotion to Mary, the childlike devotion to Mary that the Portuguese people still had. But I also think, when I told this to this Portuguese woman who was from the Azores, she said, oh, that's interesting because where I come from, that's the first prayer mothers teach their infant children as soon as they're able to speak. So I think that might too also have been a reason. I'll go through, I guess, maybe another one or two of the questions that I asked her. The next question I asked her was more of an exclamation than a question, but again, it was coming out of the impulse that I had to almost prostrate myself, but at least to throw myself on my knees and honor her. And I said to her, how can this be? You're so magnificent, you're so exalted, you're so glorious, how can it be? And she just looked down at me, almost pityingly, sort of looked down at me gently and shook her head gently and said, oh no, you don't understand anything. I'm nothing. I'm a creature. I'm a created thing. He's everything. Anyway, maybe I'll stop there for now. But I asked a couple more questions. Then she spoke to me for about 10 more minutes. And then the audience was ended. I went back to sleep. And the next morning when I woke up, I knew that it had been Christ on the beach. And I knew that all I wanted to be was as good and complete a Christian as I possibly could. At that point, I still didn't know anything about Christianity. I didn't know what a Protestant was or what a Catholic was. I really didn't know where to start. I couldn't do anything really but open the phone book and find a church to go to, which was a Protestant church. But I had two things going on. One was I knew who the Blessed Virgin Mary was, and I knew the honor that was due her, and I knew her exalted stature as the ultimate creature. And so when I got to know the pastor a little bit, you know, I said, well, what about the Blessed Virgin Mary? And when he answered dismissively, you know, I knew this was no place for me. And the other thing which was going on was I was spending all my free time at Marian shrines. And there was a Marian shrine. There was a shrine to Our Lady of La Salette, about an hour from my house. A very short digression. Monday, September 19th, is the anniversary of the apparition of Our Lady at La Salette, which is an entirely church-approved apparition, 1846 in the French Alps. And so I just want to put in that little plug, since Monday is on, like, some calendars, I don't know how this works in different countries, the feast of Our Lady of La Salette. But so I would go up there about 3 days a week and just spend an hour or two walking the grounds and kind of communing with Mary. And of course, all Catholic shrines are held by, Marian shrines are held by the Catholic Church. And when I would be there, I would frequently be in the presence of a Mass going on, and I didn't even really know what a Mass was. But when it came communion time, I knew I really, really, really wanted to receive communion. And I knew that I wasn't allowed to. In fact, when I first asked to be baptized, which is about 2 years after this, 3 years after this experience, I went to the priest, who was actually a Trappist monk, and I you know, he eventually agreed to see me, and when he came in, he said, what do you want to see me about? And I said, well, I'd like to be baptized. And he said, why do you want to be baptized? And at the time, I actually didn't believe most of Catholic doctrine, and I also still had a tremendous chip on my shoulder against the Catholic Church. And I was kind of annoyed with him because he had kept me waiting for 2 hours, right? And I was this wunderkind Harvard Business School professor, you know, who's here to keep me waiting for a couple of hours. So I was kind of annoyed. And when he asked, why do you want to be baptized? I figured, well, I'll show him. I'll just blurt out the truth and he'll throw me out. And so I said, I want to be baptized because I want to receive communion and you guys won't let me unless I'm baptized. And I thought he'd get angry. And instead he just nodded and said, aha, the Holy Spirit at work. So he still refused to baptize me, but for good reason. I obviously, you know, needed a lot of you know, catechesis and had to grow into the church in other ways. But a couple of years later, I was baptized, and so that's and I was baptized January 5th, 1992. It was in 1992. It was the feast of the Epiphany, and I was in an RCIA program, and I was supposed to wait right for Easter. And but this must be this pushy thing, but I didn't want to wait till Easter, right? And I said to the priest, if Epiphany was good enough for Jesus to be baptized, it should be good enough for me. So, so anyway, so he agreed. And I'll tell you, this is I'm just going to mention this in case anyone wants to bring it up later. Actually, the reason I wanted to be baptized in the beginning of January was I was on my way to a Carthusian monastery to on a come and see, because I was actually exploring a Carthusian vocation at the time. And I it was really painful to be in the Carthusian monastery and not be allowed to receive communion. So how does a Jew end up in a Carthusian monastery? Well, before he's even baptized is another story. So anyway, that's enough on my conversion story, or else I'll never get to the subject of my book. Let me start with that comment about it being a conversion story. Of course, the last thing it seems to me is to be a conversion. There's a unique relationship between Judaism and Catholicism, right? It's not a conversion. It's not a change of religion. The two religions are not separated as a matter of one faith versus another. They're separated by a point of objective fact. Either Jesus was the long-awaited Jewish Messiah, in which case Judaism was pre-incarnational Catholicism, essentially, and the Catholic Church is post-incarnational Judaism. Or Jesus wasn't the Messiah, in which case the Catholic Church is this ludicrously misguided apostasy off of Judaism. But it's not a change in religion. It's a difference in belief about a point of objective fact. So let me start with a two quotes from Jewish converts about this. First is from the Lehman Brothers. The Lehman Brothers, I'd like to talk, which is why I invited you all to leave whenever you wanted. But the Lehman Brothers were Jewish, wonderful Jewish. They were twin brothers who lived in France in the middle of the 19th century, who entered the church together, became priests together, became canons together, became friends of Pius IX together, and were very active in the First Vatican Council. And this is a quote from one of them. "You have heard it said that an honorable man should not change his religion. But this maxim is as false as it is cruel, and with respect to a Jew who wishes to become Catholic, doubly false. It is false a first time, because for him as for all who stray and then return, there is honor rather than dishonor in abandoning error to return to the truth. It is false a second time, shamefully false, because a Jew in becoming Catholic does not change his religion, but fulfills his religion, completes it, crowns it. The Jew become Catholic is the religious man as the seed grows into the flower. The religion was initially patriarchal, that is, identified with the family of the patriarchs. Then it was enlarged into a chosen people who were given the beautiful name, people of God. And finally, in being universalized, it became something even more beautiful, the kingdom of God, the Catholic Church, which is for all people." Then let me read a quote by Cardinal Lustiger, who's the Cardinal Archbishop of Paris, who's a Jewish convert. I at one point hoped that he might, can be forgiven for my naivete, but when I first became Catholic, I thought how neat it would be if he became the next pope, because I can't help imagining that we might be running to the end of this era, so to speak, and that, you know, we might be running to the end. And I thought how neat it would be if the first pope was Jewish and the last pope was Jewish. But anyway, so here's this quote from Cardinal Lustiger. "I explained to my father that baptism would not make me abandon my Jewish condition. Quite the contrary, it would lead me to find it, to receive the fullness of its meaning. I did not have the feeling that I was betraying my heritage or camouflaging myself or abandoning anything whatsoever. Just the opposite. I felt that I was going to find the import, the meaning of what I had received at birth. I did nothing more than begin to enjoy the heritage that had been promised to me." And let me digress a little bit, since again I have that sign about energizing the evangelizers. I mean, we are living in a time when there is a terrible misguided impulse being expressed by some people who speak with some authority or claim to represent the Catholic Church, that the Jews should not be evangelized. And I know that it rubs the wrong way. I mean, look, I was saying anybody but Christ, right? I know where that comes from. And it comes from some very deep-rooted blocks, and they're to be respected. And of course, everyone should be treated with charity, and nothing should be kind of browbeaten into anyone or imposed upon them against their will. But I can say, and every Jewish Catholic that I know says exactly the same thing, which is there's no way for a Jew to be happy in his Jewish nature without coming into the fullness of the Catholic faith. I mean, if there is a Jewish nature, if there is something characteristically Jewish, it is a hunger and thirst for the Messiah, right? That's what the Jews were made for. That's what they were chosen for. That's what they were bred for. That was their purpose for 2,000 years, was to yearn for and pray for and long for the coming of the Messiah. Not every Jew has necessarily a religious nature, but every Jewish religious nature lives in a state of frustration and some a tremendous hole at the center of it, this tremendous emptiness, until it's filled, by Christ. So one can do no greater charity. This is true universally, not just to Jews, right? But one can do no greater charity to anybody than to evangelize them, to bring them to Christ, and to bring them to the intimacy with Christ and the fullness of the relationship, which is only available through the teaching of the Catholic Church, and perhaps even more fundamentally through the sacraments of the Catholic Church. Now, if somebody says to me, well, do you think this is true of all Jews, or aren't you making a generalization or whatever? You know what I like to do? I like to point to Woody Allen and say, well, have you ever seen a Woody Allen movie? Because if you think I'm imagining this about this sort of angst at the center of the Jewish nature, just look at a Woody Allen movie, right? So anyway, that's kind of a digression, but it's kind of not a bad segue into the first thing I was going to talk about, which was, I actually said it. I mean, that's what the Jews were made for. It's easy to see what the Jewish role in salvation history was leading up to the coming of Christ, which was God had to choose somebody. See, if God knew, as of the fall of man, that someday the second person of the Most Holy Trinity would incarnate as a man and reestablish the intimacy between man and God, which is lost with the fall of Adam, and elevate it to an even higher state than it would have been without the fall of Adam, the second person of the Holy Trinity, Christ, would incarnate, within a particular people, in fact, within the womb of a particular virgin at a particular point in time, and that people would have to be prepared, obviously. They would have to know who God was. They would have to know about the fall of man. They would have to know who the Messiah was. They would have to know about sin. They would have to know about the need for redemption. They would have to have been kept separate from the people around them so that this catechesis, essentially, so that they could have been theologically trained and given revelation and so forth over the centuries and maintain that revelation and maintain that knowledge so that they could be the host people for the Messiah when they came. They would have to be kept separate from and purified from the idolatrous pagan religions around them, which were in fact commerce with fallen spirits, right? That's what paganism is. And in particular, I know this is not quite the right terminology, there would have to be a member of that race who was so pure and so developed in purity and in immaculateness that when God incarnated, took flesh within her womb, that in itself would not be a sacrilege. And that's what the Jewish people were chosen for. Then, of course, they were, after he incarnated, they would have to be the ones who would recognize him when he came, would be able to spread the knowledge of him and propagate this new fulfillment of their religion to the whole world. These are the things the Jews were chosen for. These are the things I would like to say the Jews succeeded at. They obviously succeeded, because if they hadn't have succeeded, well, there is no if with God, so I better start that sentence over again. But the fact that there are 2 billion Christians in the world, the fact that Christ came, and the fact that there are 1 billion Catholics in the world is evidence that the Jews succeeded in their fundamental mission, because that was their fundamental mission. What about the Jewish rejection of Christ? That is obviously an area of more mystery. We know a couple of things. We know that Jesus very much wanted the Jews to accept him and wanted them to to follow him. Now, I shouldn't have to say that, but the only reason I'm saying that is because there are actually people, again, purporting to reflect Catholicism, who say that No, Christianity is meant for the Gentiles, and Jesus always meant for the Jews to stay Jewish. And this is absolutely ridiculous, but it has come from some people who are actually on the payroll of the USCCB. I'll just leave it at that. But so anyway, that's why I kind of mentioned that. Now, we know that from the words of Jesus himself. I mean, we know that Jesus wanted the Jews to follow him from his own words. I'll just give a couple of citations. Matthew, Jesus says, well, let me start the passage, which is in Matthew 10. The 12 disciples Jesus sent out, charging them, "Go nowhere among the Gentiles and enter no town of the Samaritans, but go rather to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." And right before the crucifixion, at the spot that's still called Dominus Flavit, the Lord wept. Jesus wept over Jerusalem, saying, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not." We know how heavy it was on Jesus' heart that the Jews did not follow him. There is, however, another side to this mystery, which is brought out primarily by St. Paul in his letter to the Romans. And let me start with a verse from there, a short extract from there, and then go into it at a little more length. So from Romans 11, Israel failed to obtain what it sought. The elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written, "God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. Let their eyes be darkened so that they cannot see and bend their backs forever." I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so all Israel will be saved. Now, I'll go back to this and talk about this more, but it certainly introduces the idea in a very powerful way that the blindness of the Jews, that their rejection of Christ was not entirely simply due to their stubbornness and hard-heartedness, but was part of divine providence. It was part of the plan that the unfolding of salvation could not occur properly if their eyes were not veiled. It says God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see, was not veiled by God until the proper time, which was when the times of the Gentiles was fulfilled. Now, what is this, the times of the Gentile being fulfilled? We know from Scripture and from church teaching that the Jews will be around at the time of the second coming. We know this from the words of Jesus himself in Luke 21, quote, "They," meaning the Jews, "will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. And there will be signs in sun and moon and stars, and upon the earth distress of nations in perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves, men fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world, for the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory." Okay, so let me unpack this a little bit. The Jews will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations. This happened literally in 70 AD. Jerusalem fell. The Jews were exiled under pain of death. And from 70 AD until 1967, very literally, Jerusalem was trodden down by the Gentiles. The Jews recaptured possession of Jerusalem, the heart of Jerusalem, the Temple Mount, only in 1967 with a six-day war. Until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. I'm not saying that that's the fulfillment of this prophecy, but nonetheless, I'm juxtaposing the two just for one to draw their own conclusion, I guess. Until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled, and then there will be signs in sun, moon, and stars, and essentially he goes into a description of the second coming. Just because of what's happened in the last 6 months, I will just underline, this is kind of interesting that it says, distress of nations and perplexity at the roaring of the sea and the waves. Now, I gave this talk right after the tsunami, you know, and I thought this was strange. And now I'm giving it right after New Orleans. So anyway, there's been a lot of roaring of the sea and the waves recently. Now, we also know that the Jews will be around at the time of the second coming, and that the conversion of the Jews is somehow mysteriously linked to the second coming. From the Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 674, quote, "The glorious Messiah's coming is suspended at every moment of history until his recognition by all Israel." Again, asserting that the Jews will be around as an identifiable people until the time of the second coming, and that there's an association between the conversion of the Jews and the Second Coming itself. We also have the last 2,000 years of history, which I think also suggests the role that the Jews will have in this period between the First and Second Coming and leading up to the Second Coming. There are several mysteries associated with the Jews over this last 2,000 years. One is their continued existence, right? If you read the Old Testament, the pages are full of the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites, which were much more powerful groups of people than the Jews, and yet no one reads about them in the New York Times anymore. And the other mystery is the continual persecution of the Jews. The fact that the Jews have been more or less continually persecuted, I would say, in a unique way. I mean, other groups of people are persecuted for tangible reasons. It seems that whatever the context is, and whatever epoch it is, and whatever part of the world it is, the Jews precipitate a very particular animosity towards themselves, which in itself is part of the mystery. And of course, the culmination of this continual persecution of the Jews is, in some sense, not in some sense, I think it actually is, the Holocaust. So let me go into, when did I start? I have this watch here to carefully know what time it is, but I have no memory of when I started. Okay, so I'll go about another 10 minutes and then take questions, I guess. So let me just talk a little bit about the Holocaust for two reasons. One is because the Holocaust fits in, I think, very well into an examination of the relationship between the conversion of the Jews and the Second Coming, which was, and also their because the Holocaust is being used these days to calumnize the Catholic Church, right? I mean, there's this mini industry that's been launched to say that somehow the Holocaust is an expression of, I don't know what to even say it, you know, of Christianity, of coldness of the Catholic Church towards the Jews, that Pius XII didn't do enough, and so forth, as though the Holocaust somehow was an expression, perhaps misguided, of Christianity. Now, we know that the opposite is true. The Holocaust was a came straight from hell, was a direct expression of the most anti-Christian of forces. It flowed organically from three streams. It flowed from occultism and Satanism, from eugenics, and from sexual depravity. And I'll just, you know, spend about a minute justifying each of those three statements. It flowed from occultism. First of all, Hitler was an occultist. He was the follower of an occultist named first Adolf Lanz, this is actually, for details, read the book, because this is actually, to make sense out of this would probably take about 10 minutes. But he was an active occultist. He was initiated. Now, what's initiation? From the point of view of the occultist, they think initiation is opening your centers of higher perception. But the truth is, initiation is the insertion or the introduction of a demonic spirit into you, which then kind of returns the favor by giving you certain supernatural experiences. Hitler was initiated by someone named Dietrich Eckhart, to whom he was so indebted that if you read Mein Kampf, the last sentence of Mein Kampf is a dedication of the work to Dietrich Eckhart. And Dietrich Eckhart wrote, quote, "I have initiated Hitler into the secret doctrine, opened his centers of vision, and given him the means to communicate with the powers." Right? That's clearly the introduction of a demonic spirit. The chief exorcist of Rome, Gabriella Amorth, said, quote, "Hitler was certainly personally consecrated to Satan." I won't go into the other details then about that stream, but I mean, there's no question about that. It flowed out of eugenics, and I actually don't think. Oh yeah, I do have some notes here. It flowed out of eugenics. Now, Hitler was named Chancellor of Germany January 30th, 1933. 4 months later, he announced the formation of the Expert Committee on Questions of Population and Racial Policy to essentially deal with these eugenics issues. A month later, he passed a law for the compulsory sterilization of carriers of hereditary diseases, so-called, including feeble-mindedness, alcoholism, and epilepsy, under which at least 400,000 people were sterilized. A few years later, he instituted a program to euthanize disabled children. under which at least 250,000 were euthanized. And there was a continual flowing back and forth between experts in the Third Reich on these eugenics issues and experts serving Margaret Sanger and her birth control league. And I'll just give two examples, which is the director of the main German eugenics institute, the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Genealogy in Munich, was Dr. Ernst Rüden, who was a frequent contributor to Margaret Sanger's birth control review. And Sanger board member Lothrop Stoddard had written a book called The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy, which took such a central role in education in Hitler's Germany in the school system that Goebbels complained to Hitler jealously about this foreigner's book being such a central text. And the final stream was sexual depravity. Even probably more politically incorrect. But according to an official of the Berlin Sex Research Institute at the time of the rise of the Nazis, over 90% of the early Nazis were homosexual. It is well known, it's absolutely universally known, in fact, that Hitler's strong-arming into power came about through the stormtroopers, right, the brown shirts. The brown shirts were created by Gerhard Rosbach, who was a notorious homosexual, and led then by Ernst Röhm, who was a notorious homosexual. All of the leaders of the brown shirts were homosexual. Their initial meeting place was a reserved table in a gay bar in Munich called the Bratwurstglockel Tavern. Himmler complained to Hitler about the danger it constituted to the Nazi movement, that if it can be said that Nazi leaders are chosen for sexual reasons. Hitler himself was definitely a sexual degenerate. He probably wasn't an active homosexual by the time he became Chancellor of Germany, but there are a number of reports, including there was a World War II, at the time of World War II, the OSS, which was the predecessor to the CIA, developed a report on Hitler, and the psychiatrist who was in charge of that effort says in that report that he saw the police records from Vienna that showed Hitler's arrest as a homosexual prostitute in Vienna over the years 1907 to 1912. And the court-martial papers, that Hitler was court-martialed from the army, but the report claims that the court-martial was for homosexual activity. And in this report also, the OSS interviewed a number of young men who claimed to have been his partners. The other sexual perversions that Hitler engaged in are perhaps because they're in some sense less politically incorrect, absolutely uncontested. Even if everyone's finished eating, I won't go into what those were. There is more details in the book, and there's also, by the way, a very extensive bibliography in the book that goes back. Let me give a short digression. This book is published by Ignatius Press, right, which has some pretty substantial authors, including, of course, the new Holy Father. So I'm in very good company. And I am still, of course, a complete nobody. But, you know, I have very relevant academic training, right? A Bachelor of Science from MIT and an MBA from Harvard Business School qualifies me to write Catholic theology, right? So, you know, Ignatius Press was not about to take something as true because I said it. Almost everything is based on primary sources. Basically, I had to do a lot of work, and it's in the bibliography, so if anyone's really interested, the bibliography is not a bad place to find pretty close to primary sources. So anyway, let me just kind of wrap up and say, okay, if the Holocaust came straight from hell, and if the Holocaust was about exterminating the Jewish people, why should Satan care so much about exterminating the Jewish people? And I will argue that he cares so much about exterminating Jewish people for a number of reasons, of course. One is simply because they're, in some sense, the blood relatives of Jesus, and he can't get to Christ directly, so the best he can do maybe is to get to his next of kin in some sense. But there's another reason, too, which is he is in a position to know also about the association between the conversion of the Jews and the Second Coming. Now, if there are no Jews, there can't be a conversion of the Jews before the second coming. And if the Jews refuse to convert, there can't be a conversion of the Jews before the second coming. And the Holocaust failed in exterminating Jews, but it did a pretty good job of putting a roadblock before the against the conversion of the Jews and against the evangelization of the Jews, okay? From the Jewish point of view, which again I know very well, you know, the Holocaust is that big icon there that if you start to even think sympathetically about Christianity, it's what defines Christianity as the enemy. So it's a tremendous emotional barrier to accepting the possibility of Jesus being the Messiah. But it's had maybe even a more destructive effect on the cessation of evangelization of the Jews, and in particular coming from the Catholic Church, right? Because if there's anything that even has a whiff of evangelizing the Jews coming from the Catholic Church, then of course the Jews who are dead set against the evangelization of Jews will turn around and say, how can you after the Holocaust? And that's a hard, you know, that's a hard position to be in, and a lot of people back off and say, okay, well then we will back off. You know, like how can you do this to us after Auschwitz? Like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Let's see, two comparable evils, you know, massive sadistic extermination or bringing you to the Messiah into eternal life. Yeah, they're comparable. So it has had a tremendous effect, and you see that now even in you know, you saw it with the Passion movie. Whenever there is this firefight around the evangelization of the Jews from the church, the Holocaust gets pulled out, and it is pretty heavy guns. It is having a very negative effect. So in that sense, at least, there's a danger that the adversary could succeed more than we want to let him. So what is this association? I could actually stop. Well, let me just close then with Romans 11, I guess. And it kind of sums it up. It wraps up this issue of the blindness of the Jews. It wraps up the association between the conversion of the Jews and the second coming. So let me just read, go through very quickly some verses from Romans 11. That's St. Paul's letter to the Romans. I know this is not a Protestant audience, so maybe I should say that. Anyway, so verse 1. I ask then, has God rejected his people? By no means. I myself am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, a member of the tribe of Benjamin. God has not rejected the people whom he foreknew. Okay? This is an assertion by St. Paul that the election of the Jews continues. Now let me say something, especially because, I mean, I know there were some copies of Latin Mass magazine back there. And I am accused by, in an article in the most recent Latin Mass magazine, of distorting Catholic theology. And one of the accusations is around supersessionism. I don't want to spend too much time on this, but okay, supersessionism is the doctrine that the Jewish election, well, that Israel has been superseded by the Catholic Church, I guess is the safest way to express it. Now, it's true and it isn't true that Israel has been superseded by the Catholic Church. And that's why it's easy for people to misunderstand what I say and accuse me of a heresy that I do not, in fact, indulge in. Because what I'm saying is that the election of the Jews continues, but the covenant doesn't continue. In other words, the Jews had a means of redemption, you could even say, through the Old Covenant, through the temple sacrifice, which was entirely superseded by the Catholic Church. If it hadn't been superseded by the Catholic Church, it would be moot in any case because they needed the temple in order to fulfill that covenant from their end, and the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So the Jewish means of salvation through Jewish ritual worship could not continue to exist even if God wanted it to in some sense. Rather, even if God were willing to honor his end of things, the Jews couldn't honor their end of things because they would need temple sacrifice, which ended. And secondly, it was superseded because, of course, the means of salvation, the relationship between man and God represented by Judaism, was subsumed into Christianity. That doesn't mean the election has been superseded. It doesn't mean that there isn't still some mysterious special identity to Jewish people. Anyway, that's the distinction I had to make. But so Paul here is saying that the election of the Jews continues. He continues, what then Israel failed to obtain what it sought, the elect obtained it, but the rest were hardened, as it is written, God gave them a spirit of stupor, eyes that should not see and ears that should not hear, down to this very day. So again, that's the passage which shows that the stubbornness, the refusal to accept Christ of the Jews was in part of God's plan. Have they stumbled so as to fall? By no means. Through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. Okay? So, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. Somehow, if the Jews had en masse accepted Christ, perhaps Christianity could not have spread to the Gentiles. It would have been seen as an extension of Judaism. It would have been seen on the part of the Jews. Obviously, they would have felt, we own this, right? This is because we're so special. And it would have been a huge roadblock to evangelizing the Gentiles. It's obviously far easier to have Christianity spread throughout the world and draw in all of the Gentiles if it was dissociated from Judaism, rather than flowing organically from this group of people who were, in some sense, a special case within Christianity. If their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? For if their rejection means the reconciliation of the world, what will their acceptance mean but life from the dead? Okay? So, a tremendous, glowing picture of the promise held out when the Jews do come in. Let me now skip to the last verse. Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brethren. A hardening has come upon part of Israel until the full number of the Gentiles come in, and so Israel, all Israel will be saved. So the promise that once the full number of the Gentiles has come in, then the blindness will be removed from the Jews and they too will come in. Now, I will argue that the current conversion among Jews is the greatest in history. Greatest in post-apostolic times history. I guess I have to give a little bit of support for that. But there are currently about 200,000 Messianic Jews in the United States. Now, this is up from a few hundred in the late 60s. In the late 60s, there were two or three Messianic Jewish congregations in the United States. Now, there are about 200, okay? There isn't a town in Israel without a Messianic Jewish congregation, which reminds one of the words of Jesus in Matthew 10, when they persecute you in one town, flee to the next, for truly I say to you, you will not have gone through all the towns of Israel before the Son of Man comes. Okay? They've almost run out of towns. And let me close. I began with a quote of the Lehman Brothers. Let me close with a quote of the Lehman Brothers. I said they were very active at the First Vatican Council. They promulgated a postulatum at the First Vatican Council. Postulatum, I feel like crawling under the podium with the people I see in front of me, and correct me. But a postulatum is essentially a petition. And the petition was signed by virtually all of the Council Fathers at the First Vatican Council. The only reason it wasn't signed by more was when the Lehman Brothers got as many signatures on their petition as the Holy Father had on the Declaration of Papal Infallibility, they stopped collecting signatures because they didn't want more on this petition than there was on infallibility. So let me read that petition, which was signed by virtually all of the Council Fathers at the First Vatican Council. It is a prayer, and as I read it, let me make it my prayer, and let me invite you to make it your prayer. So let me read that postulatum. The undersigned Fathers of the Council humbly yet urgently beseechingly pray that the Holy Ecumenical Council of the Vatican deign to come to the aid of the unfortunate nation of Israel with an entirely paternal invitation. That is, that it express the wish that, finally exhausted by a wait no less futile than long, the Israelites hasten to recognize the Messiah, our Savior Jesus Christ, truly promised to Abraham and announced by Moses, thus completing and crowning, not changing, the Mosaic religion. On the one hand, the undersigned fathers have the very firm confidence that the Holy Council will have compassion on the Israelites because they are always very dear to God on account of their fathers and because it is from them that the Christ was born according to the flesh. Would that they then speedily acclaim the Christ, saying, Hosanna to the Son of David, blessed be he who comes in the name of the Lord. Would that they hurl themselves into the arms of the Immaculate Virgin Mary, even now their sister according to the flesh, who wishes likewise to be their mother according to grace, as she is ours. Thank you.
be a take question until about 2 o'clock, and then we'll close with a prayer. And, of course, Roy will stick around and informally talk to people as well.
I'm Jewish, right? I'll also be selling books.
So just take questions till 2 o'clock. We've got a gentleman back here, then Father Smith.
People have known me for years, said, who in all of human history would you want to talk with most? I said, Saul Paul. Saul Paul could be my teacher, that I could more understand his blunt ways of putting things. So it took a New York, via Harvard on the beach to be the closest I have to Saul Paul, Roy. It's this, the book that came out just last year by the rabbinic think tank in Brooklyn on Rabbi Paul is a powerful summary. I'd recommend this to people who haven't had the richness of this tremendous, comprehensive, concise condensation of Paul's life, the times he was in, and what that means to all of us now. But I'm wondering this, how did your loved ones deal with the pain and the loss that I knew a Jewish friend down when I was in medical school at the University of Virginia? He came down and became Catholic, and they did the whole shit. They actually destroyed everything he owned, possessed pictures, never gave his name, never had mourning and grieving, and that was it, by way of the intolerance of his abandoning all the inherited tradition that they had received. And how did your loved ones deal with this instead of being an enlightenment for them, even though you say it's additive to and fulfilling of the covenant? How did they deal with the sorrow of the loss?
Well, the question is, how did my family essentially deal with the sorrow and loss from their perspective of my conversion? Well, first it was easy for the first few years because I didn't tell them. I like to say there was a reason behind that other than cowardice, although cowardice was part of it, which is I knew that if I told them right away, they would think I had just gone nuts. I figured that if they see the change in me, they see how much more responsible I've become, more loving, you know, happier, then when I do tell them, they won't be able to dismiss it in the same trivializing way. And that was true. I told them about 3 years later, and they had to admit that they had noticed the change in me and that it was a change for the better. They still thought that I had gone nuts, but they thought it was obviously a somewhat more benevolent form of insanity. And they initially reacted with it. They pretended not to react with hostility because they thought they could talk me out of it. When that failed, they reacted with hostility, and there was a very rough period where they acted a little bit like your characterization. My father said he wished I was dead. He never wanted to hear my name again. You know, I have no son, that kind of business. That only lasted about 6 months. And then they kind of reconciled themselves. But let me tell an incident, because it's fun to tell, which turned them around, which is my hometown rabbi growing up, Joe mentioned this, is Rabbi Arthur Hertzberg, who was actually the highest profile, probably the highest profile Jewish rabbi in the country in the second half of the 20th century. He was the head of the American Jewish Congress. He was the one always called to the White House to speak to the president about Jewish affairs and so forth. He was my hometown rabbi growing up. He was my prospective father-in-law in his view. I was his like chosen disciple, you know, his protege, his mentee, and picked out for his daughter who was around my age. He was very indignant when he heard about my book. And let me tell the story of what happened. What happened was my parents went to a restaurant in town. And they were seated there, they were sitting there eating their dinner when Rabbi Hertzberg came in with an entourage of about a half a dozen people and were seated at the table next to my parents. And my father just says, you know, hi. And Rabbi Hertzberg like stands up and looks down at him and says, excuse me, do I know you? And my father says, well, you oughta. I'm Walter Shulman. You've known me for 60 years. And then Rabbi Hertzberg says, oh yes, Walter Shulman. You're the father of that. Ba-da-da, blankety-blank, blankety-blank. He starts screaming at the top of his lungs. His face turns purple. He's literally spitting and frothing. And the whole restaurant, of course, puts down their knives and forks because he's really screaming at the top of his voice. And it was a horrible scene, of course, for my parents. They said the worst part was they were had only begun their dinner, so they still had to sit there afterwards, you know, and finish their dinner. But it turned my parents around, because when they saw the insanity of his reaction, they could no longer put themselves on the same side. Plus, of course, their parental protectiveness came out, because it was their son that he was cursing out this way. So that actually made a sea change in their reaction. The other thing, which was a very Jewish reaction, was, I'll say this a little bit indirectly, there's one Carthusian monastery in the United States, which is in Vermont. The prior, until recently, was a Jewish convert, Father, Raphael Diamond. And when he became a Catholic, he was a Jew from New York. When he became a Catholic, this was the end of the world to their parents, right? Oh, my goodness, we have no son. Our son became a Catholic. What could be worse than that? Then he became a Carthusian monk, and like, oy vey, this is even worse. You know, why does he want to lock himself up in, you know, solitary confinement for the rest of his life, and we'll never see him again, and we thought nothing could be worse, but this is worse. Then he became the prior of the Carthusian monastery. And then it was like, oh, well, now it's okay. At least he made a success of himself. So my parents had a little bit of that reaction. Oh, you know, terrible. My son became an apostate, but my book was a success, so at least he made himself a success out of it. Father?
Yes, two-part question. One, when you had your vision of the Virgin Mary, did you experience her as a distinctly Semitic woman? And secondly, does Mary hold out some kind of hope for evangelizing the Jews simply because she is a daughter of Zion?
The question was, did I experience Mary as a Jewess, essentially, in that dream? And the second is, does she hold out a promise for the evangelization of the Jews, since she is one? The first part is no. I mean, I can't honestly say that I experienced her in any sense Semitic. I mean, my biggest problem was experiencing her as a human being rather than as a deity. I mean, that was my problem. Her gloriousness, her exaltedness, was so far outside the category of what I thought of as human I can't honestly ascribe anything like that. I mean, you know, her beauty I was overwhelmed by. The sweetness of her voice, by the way, I was overwhelmed by, probably even more than her visual beauty. And the love which flowed from her. And no, I had no room for any categorization, you know, narrower than that. Does she hold out hope for the evangelization of the Jews? No question. She's very active in the evangelization of the Jews. I also have a number of Jewish convert stories in my book, and my next book is a book of Jewish convert stories. And she appeared to a number of Jews, right, to evangelize them personally. Alphonse Ratisbonne being the most dramatic. That story is in my book. It's a church-approved apparition in Rome, the only church-approved apparition of the Blessed Virgin Mary in Rome, I believe. She appeared to a, agnostic, anti-Catholic, Catholic-hating Jewish man in the church of San Andrea della Frada. She just appeared silently over an altar while he was in the church. And he fell to his knees weeping, filled with an awareness of the horror of sin, including original sin. And when he stopped weeping, the first words out of his mouth were, you know, take me to the priest, I want to be baptized. She's obviously very active in the evangelization of the Jews, as she is, of course, the mediatrix of all graces. How could she not be? So, yes? No.
No, he was from a Catholic background? Okay, yeah. Well, that's part of my confusion then. But it just seems like as the church was persecuted as well as the Jewish people, why can we not say that we were fellow victims in that? I just don't understand why that accusation could continually be leveled at the Catholic Church when, in fact, the Catholic Church was in opposition to what happened there.
Yeah, The question is, you know, how, basically, why isn't it seen that the Catholic Church was also victimized by Hitler, and that the Catholic Church and the Jews were, like, you know, co-victims? There's no question that Hitler's plan was essentially to start with the Jews and move on to the Catholic Church. He had very well-developed plans, also documented in my book, to eliminate the Catholic Church and replace it with a new Nazi, pagan, you know, nationalistic religion. There are quotes from there from documents about how the Bible will be replaced in all the churches by Mein Kampf and the you know, crucifix with the swastika and so forth. There's no question that the strategy, I mean, obviously the Jews were more vulnerable initially, and later he would get to Catholicism. I'm not going to defend the asymmetry. I'll leave that to other people. In other words, there was, at least at the time, an asymmetry, because he started more aggressively with the Jews, and the outcome was disproportionately hard on the Jews. But I'm not going to defend the, you know, the asymmetry in general, or the sense of asymmetry in general. Yes?
Well, you talked about the Holocaust being a block to the evangelization of the Jews, but I'm wondering what impact you think the ecumenism and so many, I mean, Cardinal McCarrick recently had some prayer to Allah. What does this kind of thing in the Catholic Church, what impact is that having when our leaders are saying we're not interested in evangelizing anymore, and one religion is as good as another? Do you see that as a problem in terms of addressing evangelization?
Yes. the question is, do I see the current mood of ecumenicism and the interpretation of that by some members of the church hierarchy as a problem in evangelization of the Jews and evangelization in general? And the answer is yes. Yes?
Could you explain why it is that in the pro-choice movement, almost an article of faith for Jewish women, the dominance of Jewish women, is there some connection from the Jewish heritage or tradition?
Yeah. There are a lot of answers to that. That's probably going to have to be the last question, too, for that reason. I would say my favorite answer to that is, if you look at the really, really, really bad movements of the last, you know, 150 years, if you look at Marxism and Bolshevism and communism and the abortion movement and ACLU and Planned Parenthood, the leaders are all either Jews or fallen away Catholics. And I would say that my personal theory is it's the corruption of the best is the worst, and that there is a particular spirituality there accessible to Jews and accessible to Catholics. And when they get it wrong and when they turn 180 degrees, they have particularly high profile roles in working against God. There are other reasons too, but I don't think it's coincidence that you see that. Let me just say something, because I didn't do justice to that question about the asymmetry between the persecution of Catholics and Jews, because I didn't want to get on thin ice, but I have to get on thin ice, because otherwise I'm being inconsistent with what I said. The Nazis were against the Catholic Church. They were against the Catholic faith. They were determined to wipe out the Catholic faith, but they were not determined to exterminate Catholics. See, Jews were to be exterminated even if they stopped being Jewish, right? Whatever they did, whatever they said, the bloodline had to be wiped out. There was no such intent to wipe out the Catholic bloodline, so to speak. And that, I think, was an expression of the adversary's sense of the special future role of Israel. I mean, Israel in the sense of the Jewish people. You know, the hatred was just as great against Catholicism and against the faith and against Christ, but being a human being from a Catholic background was not a capital offense like being a human being from a Jewish background was. That was an asymmetry. I'm sorry, but I realize otherwise what I said would have contradicted what I said earlier. Yes, sir?
Which you mentioned, and explain to us the difference of view here. You mentioned Latin Mass magazine having a critical review. You also ran a very favorable
Yeah. No, I didn't. Latin Mass Magazine, just in the latest issue, ran a piece by Bob Sigenis, who was extremely critical. About 6 months ago, they ran a review by Alice von Hildebrand, which was extremely positive. Supersessionism is the doctrine which says that the role of Israel in salvation was replaced by the Catholic Church with the coming of Christ. To the extent that that is addressing the role in salvation, the role of the covenant, I can't probably do much better than repeating what I said. I think to make sense of that, you have to make a distinction between the election and the covenant. The Jewish covenant was replaced by the Christian covenant. There's no question about that. There was a means of salvation that was associated with the atonement for sins through temple sacrifice. I mean, it's throughout the Old Testament, right? You take animals to the temple and they'd be ritually slaughtered and, you know, and the blood would be applied to the altar and there would be a remission of sins which followed. By the way, this is also in the letter to the Hebrews. The author of the letter to the Hebrews goes in great detail about the replacement of the temple system for the atonement of sin with the sacrifice of Christ, which atoned for our sins for once and for all. So there's no question about that. In that sense, supersessionism is entirely correct. But that does not imply that there is no longer any meaningfulness to the election of the Jews. In other words, that there's no longer any meaningful content to Jewish identity. And I will argue that it's absolutely incontrovertible from the words of Paul that there is. That they are always beloved for the sake of their fathers, is in Paul's letter, the passage that I read. And John Paul II had made some very strong statements about the, I don't have it in my notes here, but in his address to the synagogue in Mainz, I think it was 1986, he made some very strong statements about the election of the Jews being irrevocable. That's the words of Paul, right? The election of the Jews being irrevocable. So I think that the mistake that Sigenis is making is saying that because I am saying that their election is still in force, that means that their covenant of salvation is still in force. And that's the last thing I'd say. You know, if I were to say that, I could still, have the affection of my parents. I wouldn't have had to become Catholic, right? So I throw up my hands.
Let me make a proposal. Let me make a proposal, since people don't want to leave. Your mother would be proud of you.
Sure.
I don't see much hope for that.
Can't hurt trying.
Amen.
Et menos inducas in tentation.